Your question then was, if I understand it correctly, that if you were to compute gravitational potential, it is not sufficient to look at the mass density of the stars that come from the mass distribution as given in the particle distribution function, but you also should take the dark stuff into account. Yes, that is absolutely correct. In fact, when doing this for actual galaxies or for clusters of galaxies, people do precisely what you suggest. Namely, you find a discrepancy between the amount of light, the light distribution that gives you an indication of the spatial mass density distribution, and the velocity distribution. You try to match these things up by saying, I assume that there is a dark stuff contribution that is then also responsible for some sort of mass density. You don't really know that it is a mass density. Okay, all you know is that it gives you an acceleration. I mean, so technically speaking, look, I should apologize for this, but I may seem to be a little bit pedantic about these things, right? But so frequently do we see in the literature that people jump to conclusions, right? So they say, well, the distribution of dark stuff is such, you know, they already say dark matter. We don't even know it's matter, all right? And they say the distribution is such and such. We do not know. The only thing we know, and you can already see that, that's interesting, in this equation, the only thing we know is that there is an extra contribution to the acceleration. That's all we know, all right? If you then assume, as you do implicitly in your question, that this extra acceleration is due to a gravitational potential, then you can say, aha, I assume a certain mass density distribution for the dark stuff. That gives me an additional term in the gravitational potential. Because the equation itself is linear, I can just simply add the two together. And then, by taking the gradient of the potential, I can find the forces that are about. And when I also know the mass distribution, I know what the accelerations are going to be. That's classical mechanics, right? And then you come up with a distribution like this, and you say, aha, if that distribution then reproduces what I know about my luminosity distribution, then I have inferred, guessed at, a contribution of the dark stuff that is compatible with what I actually observe. It seems like a very long sentence and a long story, but this is the way it goes. I must say that, but this is just a footnote that is not really part of this lecture series, but it is important, that there is additional information that we can have other than from the velocity distribution and the luminosity distribution. I refer in particular to the gravitational lens effect. The studies that Professor Kuiken, our scientific director, has made of the gravitational lens effect in clusters of galaxies and near clusters of galaxies give you an additional handle on the contribution that is in here. And the reason that this is additional is that the gravitational lens effect is, of course, a matter of directly looking at the curvature of space rather than looking at the resulting acceleration, which is effectively what you do in stellar dynamics. And therefore, physically speaking, it is a separate thing. That is also used in order to get an extra handle on the possible distribution of dark stuff, in this case, in clusters of galaxies. All right. If you were to allow me to extend your question a little bit, since this stuff is still on the blackboard, right? We see that this equation is linear in F, right? It is so by construction. And therefore, you might hope to say, well, if I take for this distribution function the distribution of the stellar distribution and dark stuff on the assumption that the dark stuff is made out of, it's at least granular, it's made out of small things, right? Rather than a continuum, which is possible. Then you can simply add these together and you can hope to solve the whole thing simultaneously. The reason that this is problematic is also already on the blackboard, and that is this particular collision term over here. As long as we do not know the physical nature of that dark stuff, we also do not know what to put here for this collision term over here. Suppose, I'm being totally drastic now, right? But suppose that this dark stuff were a sort of gas, just made of dark atoms or whatever, just like, you know, the atmosphere here is made out of oxygen and nitrogen and whatnot. Then you would have a reasonable guess as to what this collision term would be, right? And you already can find out in that case that it doesn't work, right? Which is why sometimes people talk about this dark stuff as collisionless matter, right? You can see this term in the literature. The reason for this is not that we know what the physical nature of that dark stuff is. Again, ladies and gentlemen, we do not know. It's your task to find out. However, we do know one thing, that if it is made out of particles that have something resembling particle-particle interactions, like in a gas, or like in this case for stars and things like that, we already get a result that does not fit the observations, right? Perhaps I should stop here but still, since it's still on the blackboard, I think I have a duty to talk a little bit more about it. The big enigma I already mentioned to you, one of the previous lectures about the dark stuff. I think it was already the second lecture when I talked about the nature of galaxies as we know it today. And that is the enigmatic and completely not understood fact that small mass objects, such as our solar system, do not seem to contain any dark stuff. That galaxies, such as our Milky Way, seem to contain something of the order of 20 or 30% of dark stuff. And even there is some doubt, but it seems to go in that direction. And that when you go to bigger and bigger things, the percentage contribution of the dark stuff increases, to the point that when you analyze the microwave background radiation, the glow of the Big Bang, people come to the conclusion that on that length scale, the universe contains something like 96% dark stuff. Now, of course, a physicist like me then immediately extrapolates and sort of thinks, yeah, no, maybe when we look at the universe as a whole, it is 100% dark stuff. I mean, just simply think that we have such a thing as luminous matter, the stuff that you and I are made of, but that's a different story. Why this is so, that big things contain a large fraction of dark stuff and small things do not, is something that we do not understand, right? If dark stuff were truly like we sometimes in simulations see it is, it would coagulate and cluster on infinitesimally small scales, because if you have no collisions, you have no pressure. If you have no pressure, even this piece of chalk would collapse under its own gravity. All right. So the smallest, the most numerous structures would be the smallest structures, even in the dark stuff, and this is not the case. So I mentioned at the beginning of these lectures that today talking about stellar dynamics is effectively fiddling while Rome burns, right? I mean, so much of the stuff that our universe is made of is unknown things. You know, why should we talk about stars when the real problem lies here? And the answer is, of course, obvious. I mean, we do what we can. All right. Does that more or less answer your question? Okay, thank you. Any further questions? All right. In the meantime, I've decided to talk a little bit more about the formalities of observations, because we'll be coming back to this in a bit, and it is in fact in the book, so please do not bother to take notes about this. I refer to paragraph 4.1.2 in the book by Binney and Tremain on page 280. Effectively, it is an elaboration of what is on here already. That is to say, when you want to know what the probability is of finding a particle in a given volume, all you have to do is integrate the distribution function over all velocities, right? And then you get this particle density, particle distribution function. And this particle density is, it's called nu in this case, which is curious because typically astronomers use n, number density, but never mind, it's equation 4.20. Then the next step they use in the book is only there for formal reasons, that is to say they then interpret the this distribution function in terms of a probability. If you take this distribution function, which is the number of particles per unit spatial volume and per unit velocity volume, and you divide it by the particle density, then of course you end up with something that is a true probability in the sense that it ranges from 0 to 1. It just simply tells you what the probability is of finding a particle with a certain, with any velocity at a certain location. Now, the next thing they do in the book, I refer to equation 4.24a, and I want to just take the first part to remind you of this, where they define V parallel, all right, the velocity in the line of sight, again, by taking the average over a certain section of that position velocity space, and that is to say, you take a small increment in the parallel velocity direction, and you take parallel velocity times this function, F over here, which is the distribution function, but then specialized towards perpendicular photometry and linear line of sight direction. The next thing they do is they compute the average velocity, which of course is the straight something like this, which resembles the one over there for the density, except then you integrate over all space and you get an average velocity. And then, sorry for that, I didn't copy that right. And then what you do is you take the difference between the mean velocity and the parallel velocity, the velocity in the line of sight, and you get what is known as, if you take the difference, all right, you get what is known as the velocity dispersion in the line of sight. Right, so this is simply the root mean square deviation between these two quantities over here. And that, I'm just simply going to write this out over here, is the integral over the parallel velocity times the parallel velocity minus the average parallel velocity all squared times this distribution function. These effectively are the observables, right? So it's this one over here, and it is this one over here, and that one over there, right? So we have the velocity in the line of sight and the dispersion in the line of sight. So if I were to sketch this in a sort of cartoon-like fashion, what you observe, what you observe is the luminosity distribution, and so that would be something like, you know, the shape of the galaxy. That is what you would observe over here. If then you take a small bit in that galaxy and you go to your spectrograph, what you will find is that you have a velocity distribution like this. The position of the centroid is given by V parallel, and the width over here is given by this sigma over here, right? So that is what you directly observe on your telescope. If you want to see this in, shall we say, more intuitive terms, then this velocity here is a systematic velocity, and that is similar to the wind velocity in a gas, right? The wind velocity in our atmosphere. This is the thermal deviation thereof. So this would be the temperature of the moving air, so to speak, right? Well then, I just wanted to say this in order to connect the book a little bit more precisely with what I've been saying over here, because some of you may want to find this back. Well now, I promised you to conclude a little something about the behavior of distribution functions. I'm going to demonstrate this with a rather drastic simulation. That is to say, I'm going to simulate a homogeneous disk from which I will derive its potential, I mean that is straightforward. And in that disk, I will give the stars circular orbits. And every circular orbit corresponds to that density distribution. Right, you're just purely Keplerian, as it were, with eccentricity zero. We will start with something that is really rather drastic. Right, let me give you an example. Let's call it Kepler 1. Right. What I'm going to do is, of all the possibilities that I have over here, I will check one that is called a pseudo-Keplerian disk. That is to say, it is a flattened disk. It has a finite thickness. It is such a way that you set all the stars initially with an orbit that is circular, but with a tangential velocity that is a fixed fraction of the local Keplerian equilibrium velocity. Just to make things run smoothly, I just gave it 600 stars. I'll give this thing a finite thickness, and I will make the stars rotate with 100% of the local circular Keplerian velocity. I will give them a very small velocity dispersion, and so I will pick a time step in such a way that it runs more or less smoothly. I hope that this works because I've tried it out before. Okay then. an additional thing which has not been present in the previous codes is that I have programmed in the possibility of following a single star in its orbit. Right. And just for good measure, let me see if I can do that. So any of the 600 stars, you can give a little mark, right? It doesn't really matter. Just simply take one at random. Take number 10. Who cares? Right. So this is what we have. It is a circular disk. A marker star. Let me see if I have a little light over here. A marker star is right there. So if you want to see what the orbit of an individual star would be under the circumstances, you could follow this little beastie over here. Now, when we start the system, it goes in circular rotation, right? But already very quickly do you see that little clumps start to form, right? Now, this is purely due to the statistical deviation from a smooth average. It's purely Poissonian, all right? So it's just Poisson noise that you see over here, which is exacerbated by the fact that gravity is only attractive. Now, soon enough, these little clumps here start to form bigger clumps, and they coagulate in a number of subclusters over here. Now, curiously enough, even though this thing now consists of, let us count, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 or so subcondensations, it started from a prescription that was smooth, in the sense that wherever I put a star, I just simply put there at random for a constant radial distribution. The thing is still flat, as you can see over here, and you can see from the path of the tracer star that I've put in here, that there is just simply a very small vertical velocity distribution. Okay, so the whole thing rotates in this particular fashion, and it just simply keeps going. Let me see if I zoom out a little bit. Okay. So this is what your Keplerian disk does. There is a fixed amount of angular momentum, which, of course, is the cause of the fact that these subcondensations here can keep orbiting around one another, or around their center of gravity, rather, for a relatively long time. Even so, this one here is about to be eaten up by this, but you get an intuitive feel for the total timescales involved. And already you notice that the timescale for an individual subclump like this is very, very much shorter than the timescale for the whole system as a whole. Already here, three of those subclumps are starting to merge, and I think that you understand by now what is going to happen in the fullness of time. If you just simply were to leave this thing running for a very long time, everything would coagulate into a into the center. Because it contains a finite amount of angular momentum, you can see that the whole thing still is relatively flat, even though when you look on it from the top, these subclumps are distributed in various big distances, one from the other. In a moment, I will show you what the velocity distribution of such a system is going to look like. But already looking at this, and looking at the motions as they go on now, I suspect that you already have a suspicion what the distribution function is going to be looking like. Every single clump is more or less thermalized, and therefore is going to look more or less like a thermal distribution of particle velocities. But you have, in this particular case, four of them, and they're separated in space and in velocity. So you expect a superposition of thermalized clumps here in a position velocity space. Well, now, I'm going to now run exactly the same simulation for you, except I'm going to make one small change. What I'm going to do is I'm going to use precisely the same setup, except I will take half the stars and I will make them rotate in the opposite direction. Now, this may sound highly artificial to you, but it is an extreme case of what we in fact do observe when galaxies merge. So, we had 600 bodies. Circular speed, very small velocity dispersion to begin with. All right, 0.001. So I'm going to try and make it move on the screen just like the previous case. All right, yes, star number 10. All right, there we go. Look. As you can see, it looks precisely the same as in the previous case. I used the things in such a way that it even starts with the same random distribution, so your marker particle again is over here. And now let us see what happens when in this little artificial universe we start time running. So you have two systems counter-rotating, and this is something that you're not familiar with from everyday life. You can't take half the atmosphere in front of you and make it rotate clockwise, and then half the same atmosphere rotating counterclockwise. Why not? That is because of that collision term over there. The absence of a direct collision term you can already see in this simulation, because it's just simply rotating. You're not doing anything in particular. However, at this stage, when the subcondensations form, things start to change. When you look at it from the side, you will see that this thing is still flat, just like in the previous case. And when you look at the tracer particle, it will do more or less the same as you could see in the previous simulation. However, when you look at the thing again from the top, you will see that no longer is this circle over here breaking up into a very small number of clumps, subclumps. It is going to do something rather different. The interaction between the various stars, because if you have two counter-rotating systems, smears out this clump formation that you have over here. Why is this? That's again over there. Look at this spread over here. The velocity distribution, the velocity spread that you have over here, this velocity spread is going to be very, very much bigger in this case than in the previous case. Why is that so? Because if I were to take a physical volume over here, and I were to ask myself, how is the velocity distribution composed? I will have a wind speed in this direction, which is very fast, and a wind speed in that direction, that is very fast. If I take the root mean square average, this dispersion here is going to be of the same physical order of magnitude as the actual orbital speed. So in a sense you can say, because I already mentioned to you that the intuitive analog of this is a temperature, the root mean square deviation of the velocity, so the root mean square deviation of the energies. This is very hot. a system like this, this ring here, is dynamically very hot as compared with the previous one. And you know it's going to happen. When something is hot, it evaporates. Right? It is no longer able to maintain its local gravitational potential in such a way that you get many of these subclumps. So whereas, on the average, it still looks more or less the same, and whereas from the photometry, you might not notice at this stage something that is very different from the previous case, the velocity structure is drastically different. So, as I was arguing, if you look at the distribution over here, then it doesn't look too different from what we had before. However, if you look at the future, you get something that is drastically different. No longer do we form one or two or three or four of these subclumps, but the whole thing looks drastically different. Even the individual marker particle here, you see, follows a very different orbit, whereas previously it was circling about one of those local subcondensations over here. Now it is just simply circling about the mean center of mass over here. Let us stop it for a moment and look at it from a little bit further away. This is something that you might naturally expect, right? These two counter-rotating systems have sort of found one another, and the collective interaction between the stars have brought them all together. Now, surprise, surprise, when you look at it from the side, you still see a very flattened system. The flattening of this system is purely due to the velocity distribution. The velocities in the perpendicular direction here are small, whereas the velocities in the direction of the former disk are relatively large. So when you see something like this in the sky, and you do not know anything about the velocity distribution, you might be tempted to think that everything is rotating prograde or in the same direction, and it doesn't. Now, if you were to analyze the velocity space of this system as I'm simulating it over here, you would still see remnants of these two counter-rotating disks over here. And of course, you know that this is the case when you look at it from the side. You can already see that this definitely must be the case, right? I mean, it is flattened, but it isn't flattened because it rotates prograde. It is just simply flattened because of the anisotropy of the velocity distribution. Okay. Well, to conclude, I have, prior to this lecture, made a little summary of these two cases, and that is what I wanted to conclude today's lecture with. All right. Mm-hmm. What we can get to see is the velocity distribution in some of these snapshots. However, what I've had to do in order to project things on a two-dimensional screen is simplify things rather drastically. So rather than showing all of six-dimensional space with this point distribution, which is kind of difficult, what I've done is do the following. I've given you the radial distribution. So, what we see is these two disks that I had already sort of indicated to you, except that now I'm not looking at the movie, but I'm looking at some stills from that. So, the Keplerian disk, the Keplerian uniform disk, and the same but with half of the stars counter-rotating. This is the initial distribution in the Keplerian case. You can sort of see here, this is the Keplerian disk. These are the initial conditions for just 500 particles, and these are the x and the y coordinates in the physical space of this galaxy. What I've done is plotting in the horizontal direction the radius from the center of mass of a star, and vertically the velocity with respect to that center of mass. And you see here the typical square root R form that you get for a uniform Keplerian disk with a very small homogeneous velocity distribution. So this is how things start in velocity space, purely circular rotation a la Kepler. Now, a moment later, you see that this thing is breaking up into various clumps, but there again, this doesn't distinguish itself very much from what we have seen previously. When we look at the velocity distribution, however, the situation is drastically different from what we had seen before. No longer do we have this nice square root behavior. We have centered on an average average radius over here, a very big spread in velocity, right? So this is the thermalization phase that we had seen previously. And the spread here in this direction, again, is corresponding to the width of this line over here. In other words, it would be something that you could call the temperature of the system. A moment later, the system has broken up into these various clumps. Well, you've seen that dynamically, so we need not dwell on this. And this is the velocity distribution, radius versus velocity, the absolute value of the velocity. And already you can see some indication of what I had mentioned before, namely, at one given location, you have a sort of spread of velocities, very, very large spread of velocities at one particular point, and another one here, and another one here. And that then corresponds to these thermalization clumps that I mentioned to you earlier. So every single strip, like here, behaves almost like a miniature spherical system that is orbiting with several of the others, such as here, a little bit of a trace over here, and one here, and one here. All those little subclumps sort of rotate one another as if they were individual stellar systems, right? And in the fullness of time, they would coagulate. Now, this is exactly the same simulation, but now with these two counter-rotating subdisks. You can already see that the velocity distribution is again Keplerian, except that the spread here is slightly larger due to the fact that you have these two counter-rotating systems. A moment later, the distribution in space is like this. And there again, as I had already mentioned several times, this doesn't distinguish itself very much from the pure prograde rotating Keplerian case. However, even though the velocity distribution looks sort of similar to the one in the Keplerian case, it becomes drastically different when we go to the distant future. You have far fewer clumps. In fact, you have only two of them that you can identify over here, and they are on their way to the center of mass, just like you have shown to you a moment ago in the computer demonstration. And when we look at the velocity distribution, the difference is really very, very drastic. No longer do we have some of these pillars over here, which are separate subclumps, but the whole thing is distributed with an enormous spread in velocity and an enormous spread in radius. We do see, however, an upper envelope, and that upper envelope, of course, is just purely due to the escape velocity from the system. Okay, anything that would be above that envelope would escape from the stellar system. This concludes my demonstration of this oversimplified system. And I've chosen this in particular in order to emphasize to you what the role is of the various terms we have in the distribution function over here. So I've done this, of course, by making things very drastic. Rather than having one distribution function superimposed in another one that's similar, that look alike, I've taken two that could not differ more. One that rotates prograde in a flat system and one that rotates retrograde in a flat system. And this then ultimately leads to a future that is very, very different. What I have not done, but I cannot really demonstrate this on a two-dimensional screen, is showing to you that in this particular case, which is the superimposition of a prograde and a retrograde system, you do still see traces of prograde and retrograde rotation. The system has not completely mixed. And even though it's flattened, right, there is no angular momentum overall in this system, the subsystems, you can still discern one from the other. But in order to do that, you need more dimensional projection, and I cannot give that to you here on a two-dimensional projection screen. What we should do now is extend this step by step into the direction of a better understanding of actual stellar systems. And I intend to do that in two ways. Again, from the theory side, purely from the analytic side, and one from the observational side. From the analytic side, the next time I will give you one example from the book of a solution of this particular equation that is rather famous in the literature, the so-called Plummer solution, in order to show to you stepwise how this is done. In this particular case, for a spherical system, which I had already indicated, is much, much, much simpler than it is for an anisotropic system. And then try to see how we can derive direct observables from this, in particular, the radial velocity dispersion.